This is part one of our special 2024 A Year in Review edition of In the Middle. This week, we'll be looking back at the top political stories of the year, as well as what to expect in 2025. Now, as you know, there were a ton of stories that were history-making this year. We had assassination attempts, convictions, even some dropping out and changing partners at the dance, to quote a phrase from the president. And if you are a more experienced listener, we'll call it, you will know what I mean by that. But the point being is a lot of stories grabbed headlines that could forever change the political landscape here in New Jersey and beyond. So we're going to dive into all of those this week. We'll be having Real Talk with Fernando Uribe, host and executive producer Dr. Fernando Uribe, and former congressional candidate and Our Revolution Middlesex County Chair John Sue, on deck to discuss what they think were the biggest political moments of 2024. So you want to stay locked in for this one here. We're really going to give you a picture of the year in politics. So let's get right in the middle of it. Here are my top 10 political stories of the year, because before we bring on our guests, I want to show you and tell you what I saw and what I observed in the political world. Now, I know a lot of it's usually the guests, but, you know, this is one of those shows where I kind of like to show what I've been thinking about over the past year. So let's dive into it here. Let's start with number 10, the George Norcross indictment. Shockwaves rippled across state politics when South Jersey power broker and longtime Democratic donor George Norcross was indicted on racketeering charges. So follow along with me here. In the indictment, State Attorney General Matt Plotkin accuses Norcross of manipulating development deals along the Camden waterfront and profiting from millions of dollars in tax breaks. So in the 13-count indictment, it alleges he created a criminal enterprise using, quote, threats and fears of economic retributional harm to obtain lucrative development deals along the waterfront, and then benefiting from those tax benefits that would go towards his healthcare foundation. Now, Norcross's legal team says these charges are politically motivated. It's important to note that the person who is the attorney general is of the same party as Norcross, although there has been tension between what are so-called North Jersey Democrats and South Jersey Democrats for years now. Now, obviously, Murphy and Plotkin are allies, but Murphy has long been associated more as the establishment and has clashed with South Jersey Democrats in the past, despite being in Monmouth County, which is right on the edge, obviously, between Central and South. Now, the hearing to discuss possibly dismissing the charges, that date's been set for January. Now, obviously, the prosecution is pushing back against that, so the prospects of that aren't looking too good for Norcross. And, of course, this is not the only indictment on the list. We have others we're going to go through, and convictions, too. We got a lot of legal stories, actually, in this. We'll be watching that for sure. But number 9, we got to look up to the sky. So we're watching. We're turning our eyes up from the ground up to the skies for this one. Mysterious drone sightings across New Jersey. This is something you probably have heard everybody talk about in your life right now, because people are just wondering, what the hell is that thing up there? Well, mysterious drone sightings have been plaguing the state now for over a month. And they all started with a few sightings in Morris County And now that has spread across the state and even around the country. Officials in local state and even the federal government have been clamoring for answers as to what may be up in the sky flying over our houses and our businesses and places of worship in the nighttime. Well, there were briefings held on this with mayors and state officials, and not many answers have come out about this. And despite a lot of federal officials, they've been holding hearings, trying to get some answers, and, well, not really much is coming out there. The outrage is evenly spread across party lines, so that is something you rarely see in politics these days. Normally, it's always like, oh, boy, we got the Democrats taking one side, the Republicans taking another, but the outrage has been pretty bipartisan, although we are starting to see some Democrats now leaning more towards like, oh, no big deal, don't worry about it, we don't need to do anything about it. Now, federal officials have gone back and forth on their response from nothing to see here to sending resources to the state and the FAA issuing flight restrictions in key areas, particularly around some of those military bases, basically saying the drones cannot fly in those areas. It's a temporary restriction through January. And the hope there is to try and either A, keep these drones down so the skies are clear, or B, get rid of all the legal ones up there so there's no confusion, and then they can take down the illegal drones flying around. Now, the FAA maintains there's no threat to national security or risk to public safety from these drones. But the GOP has had some success this year, and that's our number 8 story here, coming off of number 9. The GOP gaining control of Congress. Now, despite some of the headwinds that people were saying the Republicans are going to have, they managed to pick up enough seats to get a majority in the Senate and retain control of the House. Key pickups in the Senate included seats in West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, bringing the GOP's total to 53. Republicans won some races in Pennsylvania, in Arizona, North Carolina, and Michigan, along with Alaska, allowing them to hold on to their majority in the House, despite losing seats in California and New York. This brings the GOP's total to 220 seats in the House, ultimately creating this GOP governing trifecta in the federal government, where you have the White House, you have the Senate, and you have the House. But elections is also where I want to keep this for our next story. And this is story number 7 here. And that is the county organizational line, a big topic of conversation here in New Jersey. The fall of the infamous county organizational line stunned the political system across New Jersey this year. What started as a lawsuit by now Senator Andy Kim to throw it out in his race turned into an effort by county clerks to settle a larger lawsuit, resulting in a near demise for the line. What do I mean by that? Well, let's explain what exactly the line is. The county line has given favorable ballot positioning to, based on party bosses, that the party bosses for their preferred candidates. So basically, it allowed the party bosses to give their favorite candidate preferential ballot treatment. But now that is not going to be the case in a lot of counties going forward here. That is the logic that was the premise of Kim's lawsuit, where he alleged that this was causing harm to his campaign in his then primary fight against New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy. So Murphy's strategy was heavily relying on that line in her bid to win the Democratic nomination for Senate. Now, once that went, so did her campaign, and she dropped out just days before the filing deadline. But with this Senate race in particular, this was not the only story revolving around that that made the list. We have to talk about the man in which both Murphy and Kim were trying to replace, and that is Bob Menendez. That comes in at number six. His conviction and his resignation, we kind of combined it because they're both so monumental, but they all are kind of together. So here's what happened with that. A jury found former Senator Bob Menendez guilty on all 16 counts in his federal bribery trial, leading him to not only drop his reelection bid, but ultimately resign from office. When he originally revealed that he wasn't going to seek the Democratic nomination this year, he kind of teased that independent run and then ultimately announced that very campaign and said he was going to switch over as a Democrat afterwards, but he wanted to run against the Democratic nominee as well as Curtis Bashaw, the Republican nominee. So that was his plan. But once that conviction came through, the pressure started to mount, and as a result, he buckled, he dropped out of that race, and then from there, he announced his resignation and resigned on August 20th. Now, important to note here, for Menendez, it's still not over yet. He is still going to have a sentencing hearing in January. But also, you remember the drama with this in the trial? That him and his wife, they were originally tried together, but then they were able to separate trials because the defense thought, okay, we can turn them against each other. We can say for Bob that it was all Nadine's fault. He didn't know about any of this. She was the one doing all the negotiating. And then Nadine, we can say it was all Menendez's fault, and she was just the supportive wife going along with everything. That was the thought process. Obviously, that didn't go as planned for Menendez. Will it work for his wife? That's to be determined. But the reason why we're still talking about her trial is because it was put off after it was revealed she had been dealing with breast cancer and had to get a mastectomy and how to recover from that. She tried to get this pushed off even more, but a judge recently said, nope, that's it. January, it's time to start the trial. So she's going to be coming in for that one, and we'll be watching to see what happens with that and see if she suffers a similar fate. Obviously, a different jury, too. So this isn't the same jury as the Menendez trial, but it could render a same result because it's a lot of the same evidence, to be honest with you. You're just being framed in a different way. So you might not be able to read into the Menendez one as much as her. And also she has the sympathy thing of, hey, I got this breast cancer thing. You know, if they pull at the heartstrings of the jury a little bit, maybe there'll be a different result there. But as I've mentioned, this is not the only legal story on the list, because this was a year where the law really collided with politics. And that was no greater, well, I can't say no greater, but very substantially great when it came to Hunter Biden. That infamous pardon, as well as getting convicted in the first place. So in a shock move to some in Washington, President Biden pardoned his son Hunter on all of his criminal federal charges. Biden issued a sweeping pardon of Hunter, exonerating him of any alleged crimes committed from 2014 to now. Backlash ensued with members of both parties, including Biden's own Democrats, outraged by the decision. This comes after Hunter Biden was convicted on federal gun charges and then pled guilty to tax fraud. Biden previously said he was not going to pardon Hunter at all. For Biden, this was not the only thing happening. That brings us to story number four. President Biden dropping out of the presidential race in what may be one of the craziest twists and turns this election cycle, if not in presidential history. Biden decided to hang it up and drop his bid for re-election. Now, it comes after the president previously announced that he was running for re-election. After, like, much speculation, I don't know, is he going to do it? It was kind of late, and then he ended up doing it. And the Democrats didn't even let any other candidates some of these ballots. If you look at North Dakota, if you look at North Carolina, for example, they were not allowing other candidates on that ballot. It was strictly Biden. North Carolina and Florida. No Dean Phillips, no Marianne Williamson, no Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It was Biden. So the Democrats were all in on it. They even changed the primary calendar up to put the states first that benefited Biden, like South Carolina. Because as you recall, back in 2020, that was the saving grace of his campaign. He might have had to actually drop out of the race if it wasn't for the fact that he won South Carolina, because he lost a lot of the early contests. He lost Iowa. He lost New Hampshire. He lost Nevada. He was sinking against Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. But then once he got the boost from South Carolina, he had the momentum he needed. So that primary calendar reflected this desire by the Biden team to keep that momentum going. So that was a part of this as well. And also, you have to remember the fact that this was also generated by a poor debate performance by Biden, where he appeared lost in his thoughts and appeared confused at times. It followed a report from special counsel Robert Hur, after which he said that he investigated the classified document scandal. He couldn't prosecute Biden because he was afraid a jury might see him as an elderly man with poor memory. Now, after Biden dropped out, Vice President Harris had to jump in real swift and really just hit the ground running. She managed to get most of the delegates that were going to vote for Biden to vote for her at the Democratic National Convention. She then poached Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as running mate, and only really campaigning for about 3.5 months. So something very unusual. And a lot of her supporters say that was not enough time to introduce herself to the American public. And she may run again, whether it's for governor of California or for president again in 2028. We'll see what that brings. But let's go to story number three here, because this is something that has a lot of implications. President Trump's legal cases. For the first time in American history, a former president was convicted when a Manhattan jury found him guilty on all 34 counts in his New York Stormy Daniels trial. His sentencing hearing was previously scheduled for July, then it got moved to after the election, and now it remains in limbo after Trump's win. So Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has even floated the possibility of restarting the whole thing in 2029 once the president-elect leaves office. Just this week, Judge Juan Merchan denied a motion to dismiss the conviction on the grounds of presidential immunity. So Trump's legal team argues he can't be convicted on these charges because evidence used in the trial is revolving around his time in office, which the Supreme Court says that it would be protected from prosecution, that you can't prosecute him for official acts. It comes as special counsel Jack Smith dismissed all the charges against him in his federal cases. Now, down in Georgia, an appeals court there says Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis must be removed from the Trump election case down there. In the ruling, the court cited an appearance of impropriety as the reason why Willis needs to go, referencing her affair with special prosecutor Nathan Wade. And you know the drama there with those two, where they had this affair, and the allegations are that she personally benefited from that affair and that it corrupted the whole case, and that he didn't really have the experience to do this, and that the allegation is that she picked him because they were dating. And that timeline's obviously a little murky, but one thing is confirmed, they both admitted, is that this affair did happen. Willis is notably appealing this. She wants a review from the Georgia State Supreme Court, so we'll see how they rule and if that changes anything for sure. But Trump, legally, that was not the only issue for him. And our number two are the Trump assassination attempts. Now, President-elect Trump narrowly survived two assassination attempts this year. The first one being at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, where a gunman took a shot at Trump from a nearby roof, killing one attendee, injuring the president-elect in the ear, along with others at the event. The shooter was taken out by Secret Service, and he was later revealed to be Thomas Matthew Crooks. Now, the second attempt took place at Trump's golf course in West Palm Beach, Florida. Trump was playing a round of golf when a Secret Service agent noticed a man pointing his rifle in the bushes. The agent then opened fire on him after Roth pointed the gun at the Secret Service agent. Now, that suspect, Ryan Wesley Roth, dropped his weapon and then fled on I-95, which police apprehended him later on in a nearby county. Now, Roth has been charged with the attempted assassination of a major presidential candidate and multiple gun offenses. A House Task Force report attributes both of these incidents to failures of security by the Secret Service. Now, despite all that, the man was still able to survive, and that would bring us to number one, is Trump winning re-election. So there is some history that was made with Trump and this re-election win. We got to be very cognizant of that. The first one being that he is only the second president in U.S. history to win two non-consecutive terms. Typically, if you win re-election, you win them back-to-back. You don't win one, lose one, and then come back and win again. The only man who has done that other than Trump is Grover Cleveland. So think about that. It's been probably close to, if not more, than 150 years since this was pulled off. So that's a feat that we may not even see again in our lifetimes. Then also, for the first time in 20 years, a GOP candidate for president won the popular vote. That's something we haven't seen since George W. Bush in 2004. And also, a big part of Trump's coalition, the reason why he won and why he performed better in some areas that you wouldn't think a Republican would do well in, is his outreach to different types of voters, such as Hispanics, them in particular, especially here in New Jersey, Black Americans, Jewish Americans, and even young people, who, by the way, young voters do not typically vote GOP at all. And he was able to keep it competitive. And even among men, he did quite well there. And was able to galvanize on that to create a trifecta of GOP control of the federal government. And now he is on his way to putting together his coalition. He's got his cabinet picks. Obviously, we've been talking about them, and you have Gates already out and Pete Hegseth under the gun, along with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard. But you have all these people, and now he has been tasked with, one, getting these cabinet nominees over the finish line, and then, two, delivering on the promises that people elected him on. And we'll watch and see what happens over the next 4 years, see what he delivers on, what he doesn't, and how the people feel about it, especially as they go into 2025 with the governor's race here in New Jersey and 2026 with the midterms. Now, let's get some other perspective here on what they think are the big political stories of the year. Join me now is Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe host and executive producer, Dr. Fernando Uribe, and former congressional candidate and Our Revolution Middlesex County Chair, John Sue. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining me.
Joey, thank you for having us today.
Joey, thanks for the invitation as always, brother.
Fernando, we'll start off with you first. What was the most memorable political event of the year?
Well, I'm a little biased here, but I would argue that what we saw in 2024 was, not even arguably, is without dispute, the greatest political comeback in American history. And that was the reelection of Donald Trump to be the 47th president. I feel that after everything that we have lived through in the last 4 years with COVID, we were promised normalcy and competency back in 2020 with the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. We got nothing of that whatsoever in the last 4 years. We saw inflation. We saw us giving money to corrupt regimes like Ukraine. We saw a war break out in the Middle East. We've seen crime running rampant with, again, a Justice Department enabling woke prosecutors across the country. And through it all, Donald Trump, to your point, survived an assassination attempt. Actually, two, as a matter of fact. He had this Justice Department under Merrick Garland and Joe Biden be weaponized against him. We've come to learn that the cases against him have no merit. The American people spoke on Election Day. Even before that, you know, we had early voting, vote by mail. And unlike 2016, when he won the Electoral College, but didn't win the popular vote, yeah, there was a little discrepancy there. I think there was still some hesitation as to whether to look at him legitimately. That's not the case this year. Donald Trump didn't just fall into the presidency. There was a clear mandate on Election Day. The voter turnout in different demographics shows that. Myself being Hispanic, my community came out very strongly for the 45th president, now soon to be 47th president. Black Americans, single mothers, college-educated men and women. And, you know, not just winning the Electoral College decisively, but winning the popular vote decisively. It's a mandate, and I would argue that this is the greatest comeback in American political history. And with that, winning the Senate, getting a majority in the Senate, so thankfully Republicans and conservatives will have a say in judges, thank the Lord, we'll keep a slim majority in the House. And I think that we're in for better times in 2025. We can stop with the woke nonsense. We can stop with men playing make-believe, pretending to be women, playing sports, this nonsense of DEI and this past administration where we had to have a lesbian here, a trans person there. Enough of the nonsense. Let's get back to normal. Let's get back to competency. And I think that's really the exclamation point why Donald Trump's victory, I would argue, is the story of the year.
John, what do you think was the biggest political moment of the year?
I actually think the election of Donald Trump was the biggest story of the year. I think there is many aspects of it as well that come from that story. I think We can look at President Trump on the Joe Rogan show. I think that was huge. That was a big hit against legacy media. And I don't know how many viewers were there. I think probably close to 30 or 40 million viewers on the Joe Rogan show viewing Trump. And I think that was a big, big shift in the landscape of how we consume and how we get our information. So that could bode well for your podcast such as yourself, and other podcasts as well. So that was a big shift. I think another story that comes from that is the is how the primaries were handled in the Democratic side. So we saw kind of a not having a primary that kind of left the Democratic Party without a challenger. So we saw that Marianne Williamson and RFK did not really have a chance to challenge Biden, and that left him without a real primary, without a chance for voters to really vet, really to choose their candidate. And that's the situation that led to RFK leaving the Democratic Party because of how unfairly he was treated in the primary. And that also led to how Kamala Harris was selected without a real primary, without a real primary challenge. So, you know, she was a candidate that could not survive her her first candidacy beyond Iowa, and she was not a strong candidate in that sense. She saw her polling in California; she was going to lose California, her home state, as well. So, the Democratic Party, I guess the insiders, the billionaires that controlled Democratic Party, such as Reid Hoffman and other billionaires and insiders, they really pushed for Kamala and kind of did not give the voters a chance. Like we here, even in New Jersey, like if you think about it locally, we were kind of just forced to accept it. We had really no voice, no choice in that process. So that was a big thing. And another story I would say that comes from this election was what was happening in Palestine with the ongoing genocide there. I think you know that is a story that was not talked about much, especially as the Democratic Party kind of reevaluated how the election turned out. That situation, I would say, caused the loss in Michigan. There were some precincts in Dearborn where Donald Trump won. So that was a big issue with the big Muslim population there. But on top of that, we saw that billions of dollars were being sent overseas for these military operations, whether it be to Israel or to the Ukraine. But then at the same time, people in North Carolina with Hurricane Helene, they were really left out in the cold. And right now, a lot of them are without homes, living in tents. And, you know, I think that really cost them the election in North Carolina and also in Georgia as well, talking to residents of Georgia, that was a big influence in the Democratic loss there as well. So there are a lot of stories that come from this election, and I just highlighted a few of them.
Fernando, what was the most undercovered moment of the year?
I would argue that, listen, in New Jersey, got plenty of coverage, certainly. But I think in a regional way, the elimination of the county line, I don't think got enough coverage, I think, on a national level. Because like these are statewide mechanisms that are talked about on cable news and social media and you know, citizen journalism on the regular. And I don't think we got a lot of that. I know in New Jersey was a big, big story, obviously, with the elimination of the county line due to then Representative Andy Kim challenging the First Lady of New Jersey, Tammy Murphy, in for the Senate seat that was vacated because of that was going to be vacated by Bob Menendez, the incumbent, the senior senator at the time. I think on a regional level, I don't think that that got enough coverage. I think that that was, that shook the political landscape, I think, of New Jersey, like, dramatically. So much so that eliminating the county line now sets us up for a very interesting primary season going into next year here in New Jersey, where we have all 80 assembly seats up for grabs. We both have the Republican and the Democrat Party have multiple candidates for governor going into the primary next June, on June 10th, as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly. And with the elimination of the line, I think that it's really going to force candidates to work really, really hard. You can get endorsements, of course, like some candidates are getting from county chairs. But no longer having a line, you know, down the ballot lines like we saw for decades in New Jersey, I think that's transformational. And again, I know New Jersey got a lot of coverage per se, but I don't think nationally, where New Jersey was indeed the last state in the country that's still engaged in this practice.
John, what story do you think was undercovered?
Okay, I think the line was a very good selection, and but I'm going to go with, I'm going to change it up a little bit. I'm going to go with Luigi Mangione, and not because he is not being covered, because he is being covered quite a bit, but the narrative is being shaped there, right? It's the discussion has all been about, you know, the morality of killing someone, or killing someone who might be, you know, doing unethical things, right? Where where is the morality? When is that going too far? When do you draw the line on that? But I think the discussion there really has been taken away from the healthcare industry, which was, you know, ostensibly the cause of why Luigi wanted to assassinate Brian Thompson. So, you know, we do have a broken healthcare system here in the U.S., and that's not being discussed. You know, we do want a lot of people are not aware of the universal healthcare that's available in many other countries. People in other countries, they would not want to be in our system. Like, they, even if there are issues with other healthcare systems, it's nothing like what we have here. People, around 600,000 people are in bankruptcy because of healthcare bills. About 60,000 people a year, they die because of lack of healthcare. So we do have a huge issue here with our healthcare system that's not being discussed. That's the focus has been taken away from that. Obviously, the mainstream media is, you know, they have their corporate interest, and they're not going to kind of focus on the stories that actually matter to a lot of regular people who are suffering from either lack of health care or inadequate health care, having their claims denied when health care companies come back to the doctors and say, we're not going to cover that. So it is great on social media, though. Like, social media has so many stories of people who have suffered under a healthcare system, who have their claims denied, had their legitimate claims denied. And it's kind of raising the discussion again. We haven't really had this discussion since Bernie ran for president in 2016 and 2020, and Medicare for All was in the forefront of the campaign. So it's great to have that discussion again. It's about time that we move away from the for-profit system we have here. And it's up to us. It's up to the people to wake up, to demand that we have a better system, and hold our elected officials accountable.
Fernando, I want to talk about the unordinary stories. What was the weirdest thing that happened in politics this year?
Well, I think not so much weird, but to sort of stay along the line of that, I would say I think how refreshing it was to see, I think, people wake up from the stranglehold that the mainstream establishment media had on the electorate. I think we've seen the decline of cable news. I think it's been refreshing to see a lot of these mainstream outlets dwindling in their ratings. But let's be fair. I mean, they've been blatantly dishonest for quite some time. Here in New Jersey, you know, while I feel bad, for example, for like the printing press people, the delivery boys, the people in marketing, you know, there's a reason why the Star Ledger's basically going out of business. And it's they have a horrible business model because they have horrible journalists like Tom Moran writing awful columns. And, you know, the bill came due. People have lost faith in establishment media, whether it's in newspapers like the Star Ledger, the Bergen Record. We saw it on a national level. We saw how blatantly dishonest the mainstream news were, CBS News, ABC News, right? Didn't we hear, 4 years ago, well, it's correct for big tech to censor the New York Post because of the Hunter Biden laptop story. Well, guess what? Everything we learned about Hunter Biden and the laptop was absolutely correct. Everything we learned about COVID and these draconian measures that were implemented, we've learned, obviously, we were lied to. And I think people waking up and going to alternate sources, podcasters. Now, listen, I would never claim to be anywhere near where Joe Rogan is. But the reason that podcasting is thriving right now is people have lost faith in establishment media. And I think that it was refreshing to see. I think this was the year that finally everybody got the wake-up call. People were not believing the narratives about Donald Trump. People were not believing that democracy is eroding and that it's the end of democracy and fascism is coming. Nonsense. It was nonsense. We had every left-wing journalist possible, statewide and nationally, with hyperbole and hysteria. And guess what? Black people, Asians, white people, Hispanics, you name it, men, women, gravitated to Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. Not because of Donald Trump's character. I have issues with that. But the fact that we saw a disaster of an administration for the last 4 years, and the way that this media covered up for Joe Biden and his cognitive decline, the way the media would cover for Kamala Harris and her like insufferable word salads. Listen, January 20th can't come soon enough for me to get these two out of here. And I think it was refreshing to see how the tsunami of Americans ditching the mainstream media. I think it was refreshing. I didn't expect that. I found that to be pretty weird.
John, what was the weirdest political story in 2024?
Well, initially I was going to go with the Democrats calling J.D. Vance weird, but let's not go with that. I think the weirdest story I would say is, you know, I'm going to go with Regency bias because I'm going to, and just because I have a hard time, I'm having a hard time thinking about a really weird story. But a good one I think is Biden with his pardons. So, you know, I'm always calling out Biden, but he pardoned his son after many times saying that he would not, including his national press secretary, saying that Hunter would not be pardoned. And then just seeing him pardoning a judge involved with putting children in jail. And that is weird. Like, why would you pardon someone like this who, you know, obviously has a ton of moral failings and kind of soil your legacy? So I know these it does feel like these reports are being underreported. I think there is a bias in favor of Biden in some news outlets, so perhaps that's the reason. But yeah, I find that really really immoral, really disappointing, and something that makes you realize, there is a difference between, I guess, people and influence, people with power, and just regular people who would not be pardoned for committing these type of crimes.
Let's look forward to next year. Fernando, what are you keeping your eye on going into 2025?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's going to be interesting to see how the Republican Party in New Jersey can feed off the momentum of what happened this year. I was the only journalist on record calling New Jersey within the low single digits. And I have a lot of dinners and steak dinners coming my way because of winning these bets. And people thought I was crazy. Not because I looked at polling, because polling isn't really the exact science it used to be. I talk to people who canvass. I talk to people who knock on doors. I talk to people who phone bank. And there was an energy about Republicans and conservatism in New Jersey where, you know, back in 2021, the reason we got another term of Phil Murphy, the emperor, is because Republicans were not energized. Only 29% of registered Republicans came out to vote. And therefore, because of that voter apathy, we got another 4 years of Phil Murphy. And I think Republicans, to their credit, took advantage of the same mechanisms that Democrats have milked since 2021, early voting, mail-in voting. And what do we see in New Jersey? We saw record numbers of early voting in New Jersey. And I think that Republicans, perhaps, again, I have my doubts. You know, the NJGOP isn't the most competent organization, and I've said that on record. But I think Republicans have a chance next year with cutting into the large majority that Democrats have in the Assembly. I believe it's 56 to 24, if I'm not mistaken. I could be off the number a little bit, but it's a pretty large majority. And obviously, we have very different Republicans running in the Republican primary. We have very different Democrats running for the Democrat Party primary. Bottom line is, I think Republicans have a real chance here to build on this momentum. What did we see during this election cycle? Never mind the fact that, you know, listen, New Jersey obviously is the most expensive state to live in. We have the highest property taxes in the country at an average of about $9,400. The gas tax went up again. Tolls went up again. But what underreported a lot was Board of Ed races and parental rights groups that really started making noise. And I can tell you that we saw it on the national level rebuking all the woke nonsense. This idea, and I talk about it on my show all the time, this idea that the Democrat Party, number one, left the working class behind. Number two, it seemed like they were more interested in coddling illegals and coddling the alphabet mob. And you can do that at your own peril, and it costs the Democrat Party. It costs them the presidency. It costs them the Senate. It costs them House races that they could have maybe flipped the House. I think Republicans have a real chance next year to build on this. Now, again, Donald Trump's not on the ballot, so that's a big challenge for Republicans. You can't write those coattails like some did this year. But I think that Democrats have done irreparable harm to New Jersey in a variety of different ways, going back to the COVID mandates, again, coddling illegals the way they do. The idea, gentlemen, that Democrats in this primary field think that it's a good idea to codify New Jersey into a sanctuary state. We have more important things to worry about, gentlemen, in this state with rising property taxes, with a budget. Now, conveniently, Phil Murphy thinks we should cut back on the budget and you know, tighten our belts. So how convenient in his last year in office. Republicans need to emphasize that we need to get back to normal. We need to get back to normalcy. Stop coddling the alphabet mob in Trenton. We're seeing it in our school boards. We're seeing it in our local boards of education. We're seeing it in curriculum. The way the alphabet mob, I think, just, quite frankly, preys on kids. And with curriculum that is not suitable for children, and parents are speaking up, and I think Republicans have a real chance to tell Democrats, we're tired of the woke nonsense. We're tired of you coddling illegals. We're tired of you spending money like drunken sailors. Nothing against sailors. They're brave men and women in our Navy. But I think Republicans have a real chance to build on this year's momentum.
John, what are you going to be looking out for next year?
Well, with this administration, I would love to see Trump keep some of his promises. I'd like to see the tax on Social Security be repealed. That was the one reason that a lot of seniors voted for Trump, that seniors that I talked to. I would like to see the taxes on tips be repealed. I think that'll be good for working class people. I would like to, you know, I have some concerns about the administration. I'm sad to see Lina Khan go. I thought that she was an excellent FTC director. She was addressing a lot of the monopolies and that type of issues as she led that administration. I would like to see RFK, if he gets confirmed. I would like to see him address some of the health issues we have in our country. We have a lot of the food issues. We have glyphosate in the wheat. We have a lot of pesticides that really harm a lot of our vegetation, but also harms the pollinators, which is very crucial for our food production and just for life and the future of our planet. Like, they are vital to the future of our planet. So if RFK gets confirmed, I'd like to see some of those good things, good positive things get done. As for New Jersey, I'm re really looking forward to the governor's race. I've gone to many events, gone to events with Baraka, with Philip, with Gottheimer, and they each has their own strengths. Each are kind of has their own constituencies. Each has different support from different county chairs, and it's been fun to see the drama unfold of county chairs going from one can supporting one candidate to the other. So we'll see how that plays out. I like to see how much influence the county chairs have in this election, compared to the past. Obviously, with the abolition of the line and the county parties, I think they still will have influence. They have the infrastructure to push for certain candidates. They have, unlike grassroots candidates, they have an office that works full time. Each county has an office. The state has an office that works on the assembly candidates. So they have a lot of staff that works full time to help make sure that the candidates that they support win the election. So we'll see. We'll see if the candidate that gets the most institutional support, if they will be able to continue to win in the Democratic primary, or if someone comes out, someone just maybe gets enough grassroots support, maybe gets enough union support, or wherever they can find support, whether they can overcome that and kind of shift the dynamics of a statewide race in New Jersey.
Joey, real quick, can I just add something real quick here? If I could just add something. Look, I just it's more about, I think, asking John, because I obviously I know John and I sit on very diametrically different political spectrums, and
Sure.
but I'm curious that, for someone like myself who's a conservative, and obviously you've seen me roll off certain narratives during the show here today, for someone that apparently it seems like you lean very left. When you hear this narrative, whether it be New Jersey or nationally, about maybe rebuking progressive policies or rebuking wokeism, which again a lot of people on the left embrace, and I think there was a repudiation of it by different demographics, right? The exit polling is telling us that. Do you think this is something for you that you need to be concerned about as someone like yourself? I'm assuming you're a progressive, or you're someone that leans very left. Or do you think this is just cyclical when it comes to maybe people just saying, we're tired of the woke stuff, we're tired of DEI, we're tired of this coddling criminals the way we do in our big cities? Like, do you think maybe there's a big momentum shift now, not just nationally but statewide, when we for progressives like you, and when you hear conservatives like me rejoicing and celebrating, do you think that it's short-lived? It's going to be short-lived for me, or do you think this is probably a pattern we're going to be seeing for now?
I think a lot of things can happen. Like, if Trump pulls off some good policies, that could help propel the momentum, help him in the midterm races, maintain his majorities in the Congress. So I think it's up to Trump. I guess a big part of it will be the first 100 days, or how much they can implement there. But also another big part of it, I think, is up to the Democratic Party, right? The Democratic Party used to be the party of labor, of workers' rights, the middle class, and they moved away from that. Obviously, with NAFTA and with the Clinton years and other policies, they really kind of alienated their base. So, and like you talk about wokeism and DEI, But a lot of the left, and you know, I don't consider Kamala left or Biden left at all. A lot of the left is focused on economic populism, right? We are focused on labor rights. That's why I talk about Medicare for all. That's a big, big issue for every citizen in the United States. Everyone who loses their health care or knows someone who's who was not provided adequate care because of the insurance company denying the claim. You know, this is it's a common story with regular working class people. So those are big things. And another thing to the side, maybe not to the side, but it's a little bit less important than the economic populism, is being anti-war. A lot of people on the left are, we don't like to see unnecessary war. And we see a lot of what's happening going on right now is unnecessary for multiple reasons. So yeah, so, you know, it's really hard for me to predict what will happen. I would say that I find it doubtful that the Democratic Party leadership would move in that direction, just because, you know, the party has been infiltrated by a lot of billionaires at the national level, and also by a lot of, locally, obviously, there are a lot of developers and lawyers and different vendors that have influence in the local politics. So it's always hard to overcome that influence of money in politics. So it's if I had to guess, it'll take longer than sooner to address that issue. So thanks for your question. I think that was a good question, and you know, something to look for in the future.
No, the reason I ask is because, again, not to hijack Joey's show, but it's just because as a conservative, it just seems like the wind's to our back now. It seems like, you know, there's a mandate now to sort of push back against what we saw for the last 4 years. And
yeah.
I'm curious, for someone like yourself that identifies completely opposite of myself, how you look at that, how you look at that spectrum. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's up to Trump too. Like, just, you know, don't focus on a DEI, focus on those economic issues that I mentioned that would really make people happy.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to see what happens in the next Trump term here. A lot of policy discussions underway. We'll be watching that for sure. Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe, host and executive producer Dr. Fernando Uribe, and former congressional candidate and Our Revolution Middlesex County Chair John Sue. Thank you both so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joey.
Thanks again, Joey, and a happy holidays to everybody out there. And it's a privilege to talk to the award-winning Joey Block here on Fox Sports Radio New Jersey.
Yeah, second that.
You're too kind, guys. That's definitely a holiday treat for me. It's just saying that. So happy holidays to the both of you as well. And that about does it for me here. Thank you so much for joining me. To stay in touch with what's going on here on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X at @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, before we go, I just want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, and we'll even talk about Kwanzaa, because I think that, yeah, that does start before the next show. So happy holidays always around. And also, before I go, I have to have a special shout out to my mom, because today is actually her birthday, Friday, December 20th. So happy birthday, Mom. Always appreciate the support. Love that you're listening to every show. So couldn't be here without you, literally. I think I would be like in a trash can somewhere. I don't know. But I don't want to think about that. But anyway, thank you, Mom, so much. And thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with the second part of our 2024 year in review special, where I will be going back through the top moments that happened right on this show, and I'm going to break them all down for you. Definitely stay tuned for that next week. Enjoy your holiday season. We'll be back in next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.